How are you all this morning? Good. Couldn't be better? Well, if you couldn't be better, then we've got nothing to do. Couldn't be better or could be better? Could be? Okay. Then let's have a talk then. Right. So, while we wait for the others to walk in and settle in, let's bring our palms together to make our veneration to the perfect one, the undefeated one, the unvanquished one, the infinitely compassionate one, who is the fount of wisdom, who laid down the path for us and for our deliverance. Let us remind ourselves on this occasion that this is not just a mere mark of our respect or a token of our obeisance to the Buddha, but it is much more than that. It is a reminder to ourselves of our purpose here, a pledge of our allegiance to the truth, the final destination of Nibbana, and the personal undertaking that we must all observe as we walk on that path to eternal freedom. Bearing that in mind, let us take this moment to chant the Namaskara. Seek refuge in the Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha. Observe the precepts and make a start to today's proceedings.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa.
Remember, the environment is never conducive to your Nibbana. There will always be something that will distract you. If not what's happening right now, something else. Thoughts of the past, thoughts of the future, what is to happen this evening, what happened this morning. I don't know what happened this morning, but whatever it is that happened this morning, if it did, and whatever is going on around you, the lights flickering. Today they don't have sports outside, but if they had a game out there, right, one ear on me, the other ear on the scores, right? This is typical. It's because of our nature to always be aware of what's going on around us. In one way, it's our way to protect ourselves, because we have this innate instinct of self-preservation. So one of the purposes that your eyes and ears serve, as well as the other senses of your body, is to protect yourself from destruction, from harm, imminent threats. And because your mind always strives to preserve this individual that you are, it uses these five senses and it employs them like it would a guard, always vigilant as to what's going on around. Some people call it curiosity. But curiosity serves a purpose, ladies and gentlemen. Curiosity is not just for the sake of curiosity, it serves a purpose. Curiosity stems from vexation. The vexation to satisfy what your mind looks for. Sometimes the mind has a lot of questions. Why this, why that, and how it interests me, and what's in it for me. And other times it is to protect oneself. I'll give you a very simple example of this phenomenon. I might have mentioned this once or twice in a sermon before. When we talk about food, food is potentially the only way that we can take in calories. Food is energy, isn't it? When you eat food, there's little effort that you have to make to actually eat it. I know cooking can be quite time consuming. Some people like it, some people don't. But eating is not typically something that people dislike. Generally speaking, I think 9.9 people out of 10, they actually enjoy the process or the experience of eating. They like to eat. And that's because eating is not considered to be a laborious task. The whole process of taking your food into your hand, putting it in your mouth, chewing it, taking it in, and taking all these calories into your body, that process is not that, it's not painful. It doesn't seem like hard work. And then once it goes down your food pipe, then starts the digestion process, and then the ingestion, and finally the respiration that happens to extract the energy that's in your food. So that part is not really that difficult at all. And it usually requires little effort from you, besides the energy that you need or the effort that you have to make to send it down your mouth. The rest of it almost happens autonomously. But when it comes to expending energy, like when the doctor says, right, you've now got to go to the gym, or you've got to run on the treadmill, or you've got to run around the block, right? It's not, your size is too big, it's not good for you. Then they take your blood to some tests and say, too much. Yes? What is it? Come on, you've heard it many times by now. You've lived long enough to hear all that. What do they say? Too much? Cholesterol? Too much? Sugar? Yes? What else? Typically these two? What? Too much? Nicotine. I wasn't even thinking about that one. So typically, cholesterol, sugar, maybe salt, right? So these are the things, high blood pressure, these are things that your doctor will give you advice and make recommendations. Now you see, when they give you recommendations to reduce your body weight, anyone been on that side? No, don't put your hand up. I take that back. I'll volunteer myself. Right? See, I'm nice like that. Right? There was a time where my doctor told me that if you don't do something about your intake and do something about your output, it's not outtake, is it? No, that's a different thing. Your output, then you're going to be doing a lot of harm to yourself, and you're lucky that you're still young, is what the doctor told me. Because when we migrated a long time ago, I didn't know that all these foods that you ate actually got stored in your body, and that I thought it does as much good to your body as it does to my tongue. That's what I thought. So as I was enjoying all that fat and all the greasy stuff and all those pizzas and the whatnot, right? I will not give you a list of it because then you will need to. I don't want to make you feel uncomfortable. So I was just gulping food down and all these fizzy drinks and stuff like that. Because, you know, it was just food galore. And everything was just readily available. It was cheap. You could get all this greasy stuff, fatty stuff for, you know, a little more than the price of a bottle of water. Whereas in maybe the developing part of the world, those foods are considered premium, so they have a hefty price tag. Whereas in that part of the world, it's not so. So what happens, usually when people go to those countries, before you know it, the calories start adding up, and you end up with a big belly. So it doesn't look very nice, but you just carry on doing it until one fine day you get your blood results and the doctor says, you'd better do something about it, my son, otherwise things are going to not go very well for you. So I was on the receiving end of that at one point. But then I realized what I had to do to burn these extra calories, the calories that had been stored in my body, was actually quite painful. It required a lot of effort, sit-ups and push-ups and bars and going to the gyms and all those, running miles at a stretch and going up inclines, steps up and down. It was not fun. The last thing it was fun. It was not fun at all. It was not as fun as taking in those calories, burning those calories, the same calories, right? Say 500 kilocalories, taking it in is more fun than burning it. Is it not? Is it not? Look at yourselves in the mirror and you will be able to answer this question. Which is more fun, taking in or burning it? Taking in. Because one's not painful, the other is painful, isn't it? There's a reason for that. There's a reason for that, ladies and gentlemen. Why one is painful and the other isn't. It's because of the way your mind works. Now you might wonder, what's the connection between burning calories and my mind? Because my mind is a mental thing, the body is a physical thing, so what's the connection? See, your mind designed your body the way it is. Your body, actually it's an embodiment of your mental temperaments. Every part of your body was designed by an architect. You could call it God if you like, but when you start looking at Buddha's teachings, you realize it was the mind that did it after all. See, the mind was so sharp and so astute and so smart at what it did. The whole purpose of the mind in a bed of ignorance is to captivate energy. To take energy from the universe and then to embody it. Embodying it is a perfect word for it, because that is what these bodies are. You think this is your body, but actually this is the mind's energy store. I know that's not a very nice way of thinking about yourselves, because you've never thought about yourselves in that way, but actually this is what it is. This body that you have, yeah, you know what I'm talking about, right? This one, the one, this physical body that you have, that is your mind playing games. Your mind at one point decided that it needed to separate a part of energy that was in this world, that was in the universe, free energy. So what it did was, it created a system which would embody that energy. And that is what you are. And different temperaments can lead to different body sizes. That's why animals have different bodies. See, that's why elephants are huge animals. That's why ants are small, tiny creatures. So all this diversity that you see in nature, someone must account for it. Not someone, something must account for it. So you wonder why. You wonder why an ant is tiny, but an elephant is huge. What's the reason for that? Why are blue whales the size they are? Why is a giraffe that shape? Why has a giraffe got a long neck? See, all of these, ladies and gentlemen, is how a mind works. The mind's temperament determines the blueprint for the energy that embodies itself as you. So, you are this way because you are human. Now, you might wonder what I mean by human. Human is not what you see in the mirror. Human is a mental temperament. Human is a mental temperament. What do you think came first? The body? The human body or the human mind? What do you think came first? The human mind came first. I told you. Eyes on me. The human mind came first. What I mean by the human mind is a mind with human temperament, human attitudes, humanness. So then it's easy to understand how you can take different forms in other lives. often people ask, you know, Swami, so how come I'm a human in this life, but you say that in the next life I could be an animal, or I could be a deva, or a brahma. What is it that determines that change? If this is all energy, what is it that determines the shape of this energy, this embodiment of energy? It is the way you think. The only thing that food can do is it can fill the structure that your mind makes. It can fill the structure that your mind makes. So it's kind of like you have an exoskeleton. Just imagine that for a second. There's a skeleton, but it's on the outside. Okay, this is the skeleton that you cannot see. This is a model. What you do with food is fill that. That's why no matter how much you eat, you're never going to grow wings or a trunk or a long neck like a giraffe. There's nothing you could do to change the shape that you are. That's why no matter how much you eat, you're not going to grow another digit. It's always going to be 5. You're never going to get another pair of eyes. You're only going to have 2. So you'll ask, well, Swaminas, isn't that to do with DNA? Why do you say it's to do with the mind's temperament? So what determined the DNA? So you can say, well, that was half from the mother, half from the father. Well, yes. But again, half from the human mother, half from a human father. I think so. Correct me if I'm wrong. See? So what determined humanness? This is the ultimate question then. If this is human DNA, half from a human mother, half from a human father, what determined the humanness? That is a mental temperament. So then what happens if the mental temperament changes? See, now you're susceptible to taking different forms. That's why in the Tripitaka and in various other teachings, if you live the life of a god, a divine life, while you are still a human, right? If you live the life of the divine, what is divinity? To spread goodness. Patience is a virtue, it's a divine virtue. Spreading goodness is a divine virtue. It may not necessarily have anything to do with nobleness, Arya, not necessarily anything to do with that. Because even the devas are ultimately ignoble. They are yet to listen to the teaching. See, once you listen to the teaching and once you become an Aryan, it comes to a point where you cease creating all forms in your mind. You don't take a temperament anymore. You become the universe. Is this too much to start a sermon on a Sunday morning? I didn't expect any of this. We've already gotten into the depths of some of the very profound phenomena and principles that govern all existence. But you still seem awake, so I'll continue. So divine. To be divine is to embody those virtues in your mind. So when your mind is instilled with those virtues, charity, generosity, to give. See, the word for divinity in Sinhalese and in Pali is deva. Deva. Deva stems from to give. To give. See, to give is a temperament. Now, I could leave something that is precious to me on this desk, and then one of you might come and take it. And then I make my mind up. It would have been good if I had it, but hey ho, they've taken it. I'll try and make my mind up. That's not deva. That's not deva. That's why I always, encourage you to pay your taxes with the right attitude. Because you know, no matter what you do, the government is going to come and take some. Right? You can either try and make your mind up about it, what to do, they took some. But, or you can capitalize on the situation and give what you have to give happily. And when you do that, now you create divinity. Because it's a temperament. I mean, if there's something you have to do, you might as well do it happily, right? I'm not just saying do it for the sake of the attitude. I'm actually saying because there's a purpose behind that. It does you good. It's all about your chetana. Everything is about your chetana. It's all about your volition. It's all about your intention. Your intention determines the whole universe. And what did the Buddha say? Chetanaham bhikkave kammang vadami. O monks, he says, chetana, or your volition, your intention, is your karma. Your karma are the seeds of your world. Those seeds, when sowed, they reap the world that the world in which you live, the sights you see, the sounds you hear, the smells, the taste, the touch, the thought you have. All of these things, ladies and gentlemen, are the seeds that you once sowed. They reap as this is the yield. You know, as you hear this voice, this is the yield of those seeds that you once sowed. So what you need to understand is everything that happens to you and everything that happens around you, your whole existence, your whole universe, every experience you have and the experiences that you don't have, all of these things are determined by what your mind does. Your mind is everything. That is why it's so important to put this time, to focus this energy, to developing and cultivating your mentality. People hardly put in time for that. People put in far more time trying to develop themselves economically, to become wealthy, to get their education, to buy property, to start a family, grow their business, and all sorts. But they hardly put any time to developing their mentality. But ultimately, everything that happens to you and everything that happens around you, everything that is part of your experience world, is the yield of the seeds that you have sowed with every intention that you planted along the way. So I was talking about the body. Don't be fooled that this body that you have right now is actually a body for you to keep. It was not designed for that. This is your mind's store of energy. Now, take for instance, the fridge that you have at home. Right, you have a fridge at home. So in the fridge, what do you store? Typically food, right? And the random dead body in case that's... But you put your food in there. So this food is your energy store. You put it there to preserve it. Because if you left those things out, then it would rot and go bad. So in your fridge, you have energy that is stored for consumption at a time of your choosing. It is a preservation of energy. You might say, you know, it's a preservation of food. Actually, what is food after all? It's energy. So what you're doing is preserving energy for later use. What is your body then? It's a fridge. It's your mind's fridge. It's your mind's fridge. It doesn't keep it cool. That's the only difference between the fridge and this. But this is your mind's store of energy. That is why, now, the mind always likes to store energy. Because the mind has inherently, because of ignorance, it has this tendency to separate things. We've been talking about this for a long time now, so there may be new individuals in the audience and you're wondering what is this separation the Swaminas is talking about. But I hope most of you are synced in with what I'm saying. When I talk about separation, this is this feeling that you are a separate entity. And we've talked about this in the past, how it's not natural. It's a series of causes that lead to that. effect. So just as a simple and quick reminder, this is your mind, right? Not that it looks like that, but what happens when your eye comes into contact with an object, right? A thought is born. Yes, so that is light. Light travels, here you have the retina, and it is converted to an electrical signal. Those electrical signals are carried by the optic nerves, you have the brain, and there's a visual cortex, and at that point, it is still electricity, but there's an interface between the physical body that is you, and then the mind. So at the mind base, where you have this interface, it changes from electrical impulse to a rupa, which is a mental impression of something that has happened in the outside world. So the mind feeds on this stuff. The mind thrives, the mind survives, the mind experiences, the mind enjoys knowing what's going on around you. Because something has to happen around you for a thought to arise. If nothing happened around you, ladies and gentlemen, you wouldn't have no thoughts at all. So you'll say, Swami Nasa, so then what about when I've got my eyes closed, I can't hear anything, I'm in a dark room, a mute room, then what happens? Well, then you still have your mind that takes in thoughts from your memory. That's why even when the five sense organs are shut down, even then you still have your mind base which can take in thoughts from your memory. So that's why we say we have six senses, not five. Sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, that is your five, and the mind being the sixth. So it's kind of like regurgitating. You're familiar with what I mean by that. Like when cows, when they eat, they quickly take things in and then they go to a side and then they regurgitate, right? Put it out and eat it back in. So the mind has the same way of dealing with things. Then you have one of these. One of these is a visual representation of how a thought works. So it arises and it passes away. This is a bout of energy. It's a pulse of energy. When one of these has happened, we say one vipaka has been served. When another one happens, you say another vipaka has just been served. So each time a thought arises, one vipaka is consumed. One unit of vipaka. How big that vipaka is, let's not worry about that. It's one unit of vipaka. So each vipaka then is responsible for a sight you see, a sound you hear, a smell you inhale or smell, taste, touch, and a thought you have. So these are vipakas that are responsible for that. That is why if it's not in your vipaka pool, then it never comes to you. So what produces vipaka then? Karma produces vipaka. So karma is the mind's way of recharging your batteries. So if this is the vipaka pool, then every time something happens like this, either eye and sight, nose and smell, tongue and taste, ear and sound, yeah, body and touch, or mind and thought object. When one of these things happen, one pulse of vipaka, one unit of vipaka is expended. And the result of that is what? One chitta. You get one chitta out of that. One chitta, when one chitta occurs, now you perceive it. This is the moment of perception. What have you just perceived then? What happened in the outside world? You can actually, it's not technically right to say that it's the outside world happening that you have perceived. It's your interpretation of what's happening in the outside world. Example of that is color. Now we know that color does not exist in the outside world. We've talked about this plenty of times, right? So when I show this to you, what color is this? What color is this? This object that I have in my hand, what color is it? What color is it? Good. It has no color. But doesn't your mind interpret this happening, this event, as a colorful event? Does it not? That's what it does. Your mind perceives this event, which is light bouncing off this object, falling on your retina, translating that into electrical signals, and then traveling down this optic nerve to your brain, and then the interface between the brain and the mind. At that point, this event has been interpreted as color. Now you might think you see colors and shapes. No, you don't see shapes, ladies and gentlemen. You see difference in color. That's what you see. You can't see shapes. The only reason that you'll see that, you know, you see this object in this shape is because it is one color, and then outside the border of this is another color. If I held this behind, if I held this blue on a background of blue, the same color, would you be able to tell this shape? Certainly not. So all your mind can perceive then through the eye is color. So much so that if your mind couldn't do that, then we say that you are blind. That's when we say someone's blind. So that blindness could be the result of the eye not working. It could be that. It could also be a result of the optic nerve not working. Maybe something with the brain not working. Or the interface not working. Right? Or the mind not working. That's why dead men don't see. Why don't dead men see? What part of them is not working? Well, pretty much every part's not working. But what we know for certain is there's no mind that's occurring there. So now then, think about this for a second. Could we somehow create a robot that could see color the way you do? That's an interesting thought. Could we create a robot? And technology is very advanced these days. You have artificial intelligence and all sorts, right? Do you think we could create a robot? What is your opinion? Do you think we could create a robot that could see green? What do you think? Could we? Those who say yes, give me a show of hands. Those who say no, give me a show of hands. Those who say not sure, those who say yes and no at the same time, come see me later. I don't want to give you the answer. I want you to think about it and come up with your own answer. I will throw the facts at you. Okay, let's say we were in a laboratory, a robotics laboratory. Okay? What are the things that are available to us now to produce this robot? We can take a receptor, some kind of circuit, and that circuit would be sensitive to electromagnetic radiation. Yeah, that we could do. So when we shine light at it, light isn't really light at all. Light isn't really light, it's just an electromagnetic radiation. Why did I do that? Simply to represent the way that we represent it. It's not that this is how it flows. This is just amplitude and, what's the other word? Wavelengths, right? So this is how we represent light in physics. But this is just energy that flows. Now if you produced a circuit, right? A sophisticated complex circuit, let's say. This circuit we can produce to be sensitive to the frequency of this energy wave. So let's assume that this is of 3000 Hertz, 3 kilohertz. We could produce a circuit with the right components which would do this. When this energy falls on this, there'll be some photoelectric thing that happens in there, and then out of that would come an electrical signal. So that would be an electrical signal. This would be a light signal. Now assume, and I can't remember the frequencies, you'll have to forgive me, what color this is, if that's a color at all. Is it a color? No, it's not a color. You have to go much further in the spectrum. But let's assume that this is a color. This is what you see as green. Okay? Now, well, before you take this in, I want you to think about this. Is there green in any of this? Is this green? No, it's blue, right? If you're nodding right now, wake up. And I lost you like 20 minutes ago. It's not green, it's blue, right? No. What am I trying to say? You know, this is blue only because my pen is blue, but that's not the point I'm trying to make. Right? This is just an electromagnetic radiation. My question is this green? Is this wave green? No, it's not green. So if this was not green, could this circuit pick up green? Could it? No. So what can it pick up? Electromagnetic radiation at this frequency. So when we say something's at a particular frequency, what's happening is energy is hitting this circuit at 3,000 times a second. An amount of energy that's at that threshold, so because energy is always hitting this circuit, because there's energy everywhere all the time. Yeah? But there's an amount of energy, otherwise it does not get triggered. Like now we know that our ears are sensitive to frequencies between 20 and 20k. So that's not to say that there is no, unless it's in this frequency, you don't hear it. Right? But when the room is silent, does that mean that there are no vibrations at all? No, what if there was a vibration at 19 hertz? You wouldn't hear it. That's not to say that there are no vibrations. So then, aren't there electromagnetic waves and radiation striking this circuit all the time? There is, but it's been designed and programmed in such a way that it is not supposed to, it's not sensitive to anything below a certain amount. So when we say that this is sensitive to 3000 hertz, what that means is when 3000 packets of energy, when 3000 packets of energy, units of energy, hit it within 1 second, then there's one pulse of electrical energy that is generated from it. I'm grossly simplifying this, but this is only for us to understand whether we could create a robot in a factory that could see the color green. Okay? Right, so then now you have an electrical signal. This electrical signal would then be fed into a program, a computer program, and that computer program, now we have to try and somehow simulate the human experience of green. Okay, so now we have an electrical signal, which was generated out of electromagnetic radiation. Right, you tell me now then, what are we going to do with this to get green out of it? What are we going to do to get green out of it? Here's what we could do. We could write a program. Right? We could write a program. Computer programmers, if there are any in the room. We could write a program. And we could code the computer whenever this electrical signal is produced to produce or display a string. String meaning some text. And that text would have these letters. G-R-E-E-N. That would display on the screen. Alternatively, you could even do something like this. Let's assume we had a screen somewhere here. You had a photoreceptor, one of these. And you shine a green light. Okay, a green torch, green light. At the receptor. And then on the display, you get a green color. Now you could be fooled again. Ah, you see, the computer seeing green. That's not the computer seeing green. What's happening behind the scenes? How is the display showing green then? All you have, again, are LEDs, light emitting diodes, And what they do is, when they are fed with an electrical impulse, again they translate this electrical signal to an electromagnetic radiation. So the opposite of what's happening here happens there. This is an input, that's an output. So where's green in this process? Where's green in the process? Ladies and gentlemen, I'm sorry to say, there is no green outside you. You cannot create a robot that can have the same experience as you do. You cannot create a robot that sees green. You cannot create a robot that sees yellow or red or blue or any such color. Because green is simply Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara and Vijnana. Green only exists in the five aggregates. Outside of the five aggregates, there's no green. Simply put, there's no color. So now, let's say there's a robot that could scan you and tell your complexion. Let's assume that there was a robot that could scan you, that we have a scanner, hold it to your skin, and it displays a complexion. Do you think that it's actually seeing your color, the color of your skin, and then displaying it in some words? No, that's not what's going on. This is simply mathematics. It is simply logic. And some words, even if it displayed the color that you are holding out to the receptor on the display, what's really happening is it's just emitting light out of those diodes. And those diodes, these light signals that are emitted just as it did off this object, those diodes will be emitting light signal, electromagnetic radiation, which will then hit your eye and then starts the color process. Let's go to the traffic light first. So what colors do you have in the traffic light? Now you would have passed many on your way here, right? So what color is the traffic light? Red, amber, and green, right? I mean, surely it's red, isn't it? The red is red. So what color is the traffic light? So when they say, when the lights go red, stop. And then when the lights go amber, get ready. And then when the lights are green, go. What color are the traffic lights? They're of no color at all. Color only exists in your world. Without vipaka, you cannot have color. Without vipaka, you cannot have color. So what vipaka draws to a robot? What is a robot's vipaka? You can't just say no, right? You have to have an explanation behind this. What vipaka is drawn to a robot? Why is no vipaka drawn to a robot? No karma. Because vipaka is only available where there is a process that generates vipaka. And the process that generates vipaka is called karma. What is karma then? Karma happens when you have a chitta, and in that chitta you have ignorance and attachment, and then you do what you call bhava, which is the aggregation of energy, right, with a dose of raga, dvesha or moha. You need to have a bit of raga, dvesha or moha. Without raga, dvesha, moha, you cannot have bhava. That's why an arahant is vita raga, vita dvesa, vita moha. No bhava happening there. That's why an arahant is void of karma. When no karmas happen, no vipaka is generated. When there's no vipaka, there's no green. So could you ever create a robot that could see color? That is impossible. What about smell? What about smell? Smell in the way that you experience it. Now when you do your perfume, which you did this morning, you did, right? Others will be grateful that you did. So that's that perfume when you spray it and you get that smell. That experience of smell I'm talking about. You know the experience of that smell. You hold a rose to your hair, to your nose, and the smell of rose, or the smell of a freshly baked loaf of bread, or a cookie, or a cake. Enough, Swami Mahansa. Don't torture us like this, Swami Mahansa. I can hear you say so. I will stop. So, when you have these experiences. Do you think a robot could ever experience that? It's not possible, ladies and gentlemen. It's actually impossible. It's not improbable. It's actually impossible. Zero probability. Never would it be possible for a robot to experience sight, sound, smell, taste, or even touch for that matter. But have you not seen those robots that, you know, do your vacuuming? And they, you know, they roam around your living room, like picking up dust and dirt and all sorts. And then it bumps into a wall. What does it do? It says, ouch, and then? It changes its course, doesn't it? So did it not just experience that touch? Did it not experience that touch? No. Not in the way that you experience touch. That's just an electrical signal. Electrical signal was triggered, just like it happens on you as well. You know, when you press your palms together, touch is not felt here. Let's be certain of that. Touch is not felt here, although you feel, you think that it happens here. It doesn't. When you rub your hands like this, this friction that you feel is not generated here. Physical friction may be, it's here, of course it is, because here are the two objects or the two surfaces that slide on one another. So physical friction is here, but I'm talking about the experience of friction. Now as you keep doing this, what's going to happen? You're going to feel what? Warmth. Right? You're going to produce heat, you'll say. That warmth is not felt here. You have heat receptors. Actually, they're not heat receptors at all. They're energy receptors. Those receptors will only take electrical signals down your body, up your system to your brain again. Even at the brain, ladies and gentlemen, there's no color, there's no smell, there's no taste, there's no touch, there's no warmth, there's no pressure, there's none of this. Not even at the brain. The brain is a center full of neuroelectrical activity. That's what's going on there. There's lots of chemicals bouncing here and there. There's a lot of electricity going on there. It's like it's just a hub of a lot of electrical activity there. But sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, color, none of these things exist in the brain. For those things to happen, there has to be that interface. It has to cross that interface. This is the brain-mind interface. To a point where that environment then starts to draw vipaka. And only the mind is privy to vipaka. Only the mind can draw on vipaka. And why is that? Why is it only mind can draw vipaka? Why can't this draw vipaka? Because what is it that generates vipaka? Only the mind generates vipaka. So vipaka does not exist in a world where there is no minds, where there are no minds. And karma does not exist in a world where there are no minds. So then, if your bodies are a representation of your mental temperaments, when these karma are produced, right? When a karma is produced at the mind, it produces some energy up here. So I was talking about DNA, because that was a question that you had in mind. Are we not shaped by our DNA? Isn't that the architecture? Isn't that the blueprint? Well, it is, but the DNA is also determined by the karma that you have done. That is why if you steal someone's sense of sight, chances are if that karma comes to fruition at the point of your birth, then you will be born blind. Give or denying. That's God in action. So then if someone is blind, blind from birth, I see logic there. I can see how this is a result of them having deprived someone of the sense of sight. And this is a result of that. So although we might feel sympathetic, we might feel empathy towards them, we might feel sorry and compassionate and all that, it's all good because it's our duty to serve those who need our help and support and all that. That's all great. But what we must understand is these are the consequences of their own actions. Therefore, whilst we help them to retrieve, to regain their sense of sight, if at all possible. So medical science will try and do what it can. Physicists will try and do what they can. They will try and develop electrical circuits that can help them to see in some way. This is all good. And in fact, whenever scientists work together, whenever people work together to produce things like this, this technology that helps people see, they're actually giving the sense of sight. That's a meritorious deed. If sight was lost because sight was deprived, then what would happen when you give sight? Now it's a gift. Every gift has a return. Therefore, actually, if you are involved in any enterprise, in any piece of work that involves some of these things, giving sight, giving foresight, giving hindsight, this is also sight. Giving the sense of smell, giving the sense of taste, giving the sense of touch. A lot of doctors, medical fields, research people, scientists, there's a lot of good work going on in that space. So we never discourage that. Of course, we always encourage that. That's good. But what we must understand is, ladies and gentlemen, all that does is simply create the environment. Whereas if they were born without the gift of sight, no matter what you do, you will not be able to reinstate their sense of sight until the next opportunity where a karma that includes the sense of sight, they are born with such karma. Unless you are born with sense of sight intact. If you are born with a sense of sight intact, then if there are physical deformities, they can be fixed by medical science. But if your karma, your karmic body, that's what we call it, the karmic body, if the karmic body lacks the sense of sight, there's nothing you can do to restore that. If your karmic body is male, there's nothing you can do to transform yourself to a female. If your karmic body lacks intelligence, then there's nothing one can do to reinstate intelligence. You can't teach people like that. Now, don't you see sometimes you have children, adults in society where they're born with, you can see, a mental deformity, a mental disability. One might ask me, Swaminathan, don't you feel sympathetic towards them? Don't you feel sorry? It's not sorry that I feel towards them. I see what has happened. I see cause and effect. And so what we try and do is to set them back on the right track so that their mental temperaments change. This is why, ladies and gentlemen, ultimately, no one else can be your savior. You are your own salvation. If you have deprived people of good insight, if you live a life lying to people, if you live a life depriving people of mental happiness, mental peace, intelligent choices, chances are you're creating your karma, which might manifest itself later on in the next life with such kind of a mental deformity. Sometimes people ask me, Swaminathan, is it wrong to drink, consume intoxicants? Now this is, I know, a very sensitive topic. Don't wield your swords at me, or pull out your bow and arrow, okay? Spare me that, please. People ask me, is it wrong to intoxicate or take intoxicants? See, here's what happens. When you take an intoxicant, and if you're taking it for the purpose of becoming intoxicated, you're doing a karma now. You're doing a karma. You can't stop yourself from committing karma for as long as there's ignorance in your mind, because it's not something you deliberately do. It happens. Because there's no doer in any of this. There's only the done. Cause and effect, that's it. So when you intoxicate yourself, ladies and gentlemen, here are the dangers, the perils, right, of intoxicating yourself. When you intoxicate yourself, either through drugs, liquid drugs, or various other things, what happens is you're producing karma that puts itself in your karmic strand, okay? Depriving of good sense, good sight, intelligence, making right choices, the ability to do that. Because that's what happens when you're intoxicated. You can't think straight. That you don't know your left from your right. Then you lose your sense of bearing, your sense of right and wrong, your sense of morality, all of those things are lost. When you intoxicate yourself, I mean. But when you create such kind of karma, now you're at risk. Because if one of those karmas come forward at the point of your rebirth, then you might just be born with the mental temperament that no matter what you do, you now cannot imbibe into that mind proper intelligence and thoughtfulness and intellectual ability, intellectual capacity. Actually, that karmic body has now been deprived of that. There's nothing you can do now to fix it. These are sometimes things that you see around you, the causes or the results of such causes. So people don't realize that when they take intoxicants, this has long-lasting results. They think that the only harm they're doing is to their physical body in this life. It is not. The unseen damage is a million times, if not more, than the damage that you see to your bodies. Because if you deprive yourself of intelligence, intelligent choices, right, the ability to pick right from wrong, if you deprive yourself of that and karma is produced at that point, then you are going to deprive yourself of that ability in that karma. When that karma seed comes to fruition, now it will be born, it will come to pratisandhi, to fruition, without that ability. So if it doesn't have the ability, how can you feel it? I'll ask you a very simple question. You know, take this cup, right? If this cup was turned upside down, what can you do to fill it with water? If this cup was turned upside down, what is it you can do to fill it with water? You might say, but we turn it back around. No, you can't do that. Because if your karmic body was born that way, now there's nothing you can do. Even worse, what if there was a hole in it? Then what might you be able to do? If there's a hole in it, and if you can't fix it, there's nothing you can do. But if there's a hole in it, you might be able to, physically, if there's a physical change you can do, then that might be possible. But when you are born a certain way, your karmic body is a certain way, that karmic body cannot be fixed. What can only be fixed is the physical body. That's why doctors study physiology. Doctors don't study karmology. For that you have to come to doctors in the sasana. Permit me to make reference to a Sinhalese term here. I will explain it for those who don't speak the language. In Sinhalese, the word for treatment is what? Where's the duster gone? No duster today. on the eyes. Thank you. What's the Singhalese term for treatment? Prati? Kara o? Karma. That's pronounced. So, for those who cannot read Singhalese, this is how you pronounce it. Prati? Karma. Kara, yes. Karma is also, you can also call it pratikarma. Right? They're both right. See, you need to do pratikarma to undo the karma that was done that brought about the ailment in the first place. Medicine cannot do that. Medicine cannot do that. Physiology cannot fix that. Because karma was not done by the body, it was done by the mind. Therefore, now you need prati karma. That is why now, if you may have heard this, doctors in the past, right, our ancestral doctors, usually when your patient goes for treatment, right, and if it's quite complex what ailment they have, and simple changes to the body cannot fix it. The body is merely the environment. Okay, what they typically tend to do is they advise them to go and do some merit work. Yes? Yeah. You don't have that now. When you channel the doctor at a private hospital somewhere, do they say, first go to the pansala and offer a dhane, do a Buddha puja, Bodhi puja, and then come? They don't, right? They don't do that. Because they study physiology, not karmology. Your physiology is an extension of your karma. It's a physical representation of your karma. Like I said before, your body is merely your mind's energy store. So the shape in which your body stores energy is determined by the mind. That's why some of you have female form, others have male form. Your mind decided that. You will say, no, DNA decided that. Yes, I accept. But take a step back again. Don't stop at DNA. Remember, DNA was introduced by science. Science always tries to come up with explanations for what they observe. That's why from time to time they will keep on replacing those explanations, one with another. Science is never complete. Today they'll say something, tomorrow they'll say, actually skip, scrap that, we've got a better explanation. New theories, new laws, new principles, they always keep coming out, right? But when the Buddha said it once, he said it once and that was it. Because he didn't take the empirical approach. He scanned the universe. His teaching was based in wisdom. Today's science teaching is based in knowledge. Knowledge is on the opposite spectrum of wisdom. Where there is no wisdom, there's a lot of knowledge. Where there is enough and abundance of wisdom, there is no need for knowledge. We talked about this, I think, once. Was it in a Singhalese sermon or an English sermon? We talked about it, right? Yeah. Some of you are looking at me with blank faces. This is where wisdom is. This is where knowledge is. When your mind does not accept that all things are one, everything's the same stuff, and all there are just simply manifestations of the same stuff, the whole universe is the same. Like when the mind does not accept that you are the same as you, madam, and this, you are the same, you, madam, as you, as you, sir. When the mind doesn't accept that, and the mind wishes to experience an individuality, entity, Each of these entities have a description. They have a size, they have a length, they have a width, they have characteristics, attributes. Each of those pieces of fact is knowledge. So when the mind separates itself and then creates a world through which it can explain these differences, now you need lots of knowledge. But if the mind can see beyond these superficial separations, and that actually all there is just one truth, one source, now you realize that when you are at wisdom, everything's the same, everything's one. If there's one, then how many things must you talk about? Just one. The truth. Because this is all-encompassing. This is not. So today is modern science, right? Physiology, biology, physics, chemistry, all these things that are the root of modern medicine. You think they're looking for answers here or here? With every year that we advance in chemistry, biology, medicine, right? They keep pushing and pulling this way. So we call that progress. Okay. Who am I to argue? Okay. I'm going to get out of this place sooner or later. So whatever the world wants to do, let them do it. I'm going to get the heck out of this place as soon as I can. While I'm here, I will talk to a few people and see who might be willing to understand what I'm trying to tell them. Who might be able to strike a chord with me. And who might be able to resonate with the truth of the universe. They can come with me. And if it's not their turn now, then someone else will come again later. Maybe another 500 years, and then some will go with them. Until then, the world must thrive. It must survive. Therefore, new discoveries must happen. Every time there's a new discovery, people, you know, they hurrah, they enjoy, and they party, they celebrate. But what I realize is every time there's a new discovery, that's one step again further from the truth. Because, you know, when someone discovers something, what do they say? We have found a new thing. We have found a new species. And then they quickly go and put a name to that species, usually based on the name of the person who discovered it. Yeah? Because it's an opportunity to talk about your ego. Why not? Sometimes, you know, those things are named in honor of the individual who discovered it. But then again, why is that an honor? That's the question worth asking, is it not? If a new plant was discovered by a certain scientist, like let's say his name was Frederick, then they named the plant Fredericosa. Just. And they say it's in honor of the scientist who discovered it, or the botanist who discovered it. My question is this, it's not about the fact that they named it, but why is it an honor? Why would the scientists consider it an honor to them that they have named it after him? Because it feeds their pride. I did it, therefore I get credit for it, the world gives me credit for it. What credit are we talking about here? If there was no pride, where's credit there? I know I'm tearing the social fabric here into smithereens. That's why people like me should not be allowed to speak. I agree with everyone on that point. People like me should not be allowed to speak. We should not be allowed to stand on a podium or stand behind a mic or open our mouths for that matter. We should be shoved into a dark cave somewhere and sealed shut until the end of time. Because every time we say something, it goes against the social convention. Always goes against the social convention. Because social conventions are for convenience. A convention always serves the purpose of convenience. That's why we call it a duster, without actually referring to it with its actual name. In fact, this has no name. The absolute address to this would be carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, and then proportion of it. You can give it a chemical formula, but even those chemicals have names. What is carbon? 6 protons, 6 electrons, 6 neutrons. Why do you call it carbon? Why don't you just call it 6 of this? 6 electrons and 6 protons. Why don't you just call it that? Because it's not convenient to keep calling it that. So they come up with a name for it. Now there's a convention. Convention is for convenience. That whenever we speak, we tear into that convenience, those conventions, and we show you the absolute truths behind it. Because here's why we do that, Lizman. It's not because, you know, my back's scratching or something. I do it because it's important for you to understand that all these attachments that you have are to things that are in the conventional world. These attachments that you have are to the objects in the conventional world. You're not attached to anything absolute. Are you? Are you attached to the First Noble Truth? Don't you say anything but not First Noble Truth. Understand? What are you attached to? You're attached to your children. You're attached to your parents. You're attached to your house. You're attached to your land. You're attached to your pet dog. You're attached to food. You're attached to clothes. You're attached to color. You're attached to, you know, all these things. You're attached to conventional things. So for as long as in your mind these conventional things exist, your attachment will exist. If you remember one of the very first talks we did long time ago, right, when we talked about attachment, I told you that the Buddha's teaching is not to let go of the things you're attached to. It's to realize that there is nothing to be attached to. Now do you understand what that meant? It is not to let go of this. It is to understand that this doesn't exist in the first place. Then what are you attached to? What's the foundation for attachment? What's the basis for attachment if this doesn't exist in the first place? That's the point. Trying to let go of attachment is like a dog chasing its own tail. No point in doing that. Because today you'll be attached to this, so you try and let go of your attachment to that, but you'll pick up something else to be attached to. That's how it happens. You know, think about most people when they want to try and give up a certain habit, right, whether that's smoking, watching TV or something. What is the common advice that's given? Focus your attention on something else. If it's alcohol you're attached to, find a different hobby. Pick up your guitar. Learn to play an instrument. Pick up some hobby. Go to the local club. Do something there. Make some friends. So what are they saying? Give up your attachment to this. Replace it with something else. You're still in samsara. But it's convenient. Yes. I myself studied these things in the past and then I realized, you know, what is the point of doing this? That's why it's just a dog chasing its own tail. To let go of one attachment, you just pick up another. What was the point? From the pan to the fire, and from the fire to the pan again, and then to the fire again, and then to the pan again, and to the fire again. What's the point? You're going to jump off the stove. Otherwise you're just jumping between the pan and the fire. What's the point? So now do you see why doctors of the past, our ancestral doctors, typically Ayurvedic doctors, even to this day maybe they do it, but I think it's less common now, much less common than it used to be. But the village doctor, long time ago I'm talking about, maybe a few generations ago, they would ask you to go and do some meritorious deed. Why was it always a meritorious deed? Not go and kill some cows or something. Why not that? You know, it was like release a cow that has been taken to the abattoir. Or go and do a Deva Puja. or a Buddha puja, or a Bodhi puja, something like that. Or go and give a Sanghika dana. Or even a Balukapata dana. Something. Something meritorious. Because what that did, ladies and gentlemen, what they could do with their understanding of karma, because they were karmologists, because they associated with the Dhamma. Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha is what they associated with. They would start the morning reflecting the Dhamma, contemplating the Dhamma. They had sought refuge in the Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha, and they'd realized that this treatment, this me being a doctor, is only a means to an end. This is not what I want to be for the rest of my life. Most of them did it because they had something better to do, which was they were focusing on Nibbana. But while they were still laymen, while they had to still run a family, right? They did what they had to do as a member of society, because they were not a part of the Sangha community. They were a lay individual. So as a doctor, teacher, farmer, right? They would serve their community. But what they wanted to do was pave a path for themselves as well as those who would come seeking their help and support to ultimately get to the ultimate truth, Nibbana. That's why those days they didn't use to take money for treatment. Doctors of the past, all they would have to give them is one of these. Treatment in exchange for a Buddhat Koli. This is only a mark of respect for that wisdom. Not necessarily to the doctor, because the doctor knew that there is no doctor here. But the teaching was there. It was a mark of respect. It was a mark of reverence. And it was a sign to say that I resonate with you. I'm here to treat myself because I want to be a good man. I'm also virtuous, and I want to be more virtuous, and I also want to get to Nibbana, because it was the unsaid truth. Everyone knew that what they wanted to get out of life was attaining the ultimate wisdom, ultimate truth, ultimate freedom, because people are closely associated with the Mahasangha, with the Buddha, the Mahasangha, with the Dhamma, because people had time to do all that. And there were less influences from other parts of the world, and there was no internet, no TV. So people had time. People still have time today, but that time is taken up by your TV. Therefore you don't have time to spend with your family, friends, parents. It's not that people don't have time. You know, once in a while you go to your phone settings and find out how much time you spent, screen time, you'll be shocked at what you see. How much time, you know, you always say, I don't have time. But have a look at how much time you've spent on Facebook, how much time you spent on Instagram, how much time you spent on social media, YouTube and so on, watching things that just didn't mean anything to you, just consumed your time. Then you will see how much time there was actually there to spend time with your friends, your family, to go to the temple, to go to the church, to go to the mosque, to go to the kovil, to be religious, to be virtuous, to cultivate your mental virtues. There's always time, ladies and gentlemen. The thing is, these things steal your time. Unbeknown to you, then you realize at the end of the day, no time. When you sit in front of the TV watching a game of cricket, football, whatever, right? How many hours of your time does that kill? Think about it. How many hours of your time does that kill? You know, whether it's tennis, Formula One, football, cricket, swimming, Olympics, you name it. All you're getting out of it is a mental kick. A mental satisfaction. It's like a mental kichi. A tickle. That's all you get out of it, a mental tickle. What good does it do to your body? You see the soccer players running here and there, exercising their bodies, and they are athletic, right? They're running here, there, everywhere. They're very strong and agile and very athletic. What good does that do to you while you watch it? Huh? Especially if you have those crisps open in a bag. Don't even know what your hand is doing. You only know that you've finished because your hand hits your fingers hit the bottom and it's empty. You have the drinks here, you have the fizzy drinks there. Isn't this how you might have spent many of your valuable lively hours? Sorry to say, ladies and gentlemen, you're just wasting your life. You're wasting your life. I'm not going to say time. You're wasting your life. I'm sorry to say this, but that is the truth. I don't encourage watching sport. Sorry. Then he'll ask me, but what are we supposed to do? Aren't we supposed to watch sport and celebrate and all that? Get the score at the end if you want to, really want to. Just get the score at the end. If you want to know who won, just get the score at the end. Why should you sit throughout the whole 3 hours, 4 hours, 5 hours, 6 hours, sometimes a whole tournament? What do you get out of it? You burned electricity, your TV's LEDs have been burned, like your eyes have been exhausted. And most of all, you're spending something you can never get back. Ask yourself, why are those things shown to you for free? If something's ever given to you for free, you are the commodity being sold. Don't you forget that. Sorry, but this is the ugly truth. I myself used to sit in front of the TV, watch cricket, because I love cricket. I love watching cricket, not necessarily playing cricket. Now I kick myself in the back whenever I'm reminded of that. Like I said, I should not be allowed to speak. Don't you agree? Because half of this nation survives on watching cricket. If you didn't have the cricket tournaments, then there would be mayhem. Then there's another part of the world, the western part of the world. They survive on football. Then there's another part of the world, they survive on golf. I mean, not even the players get the exercise there. Not for me to criticize, but you know, these are just made up sports. Once again, I should not be allowed to speak, right? I get it, you know, there's an element of sophistication there. You know, you've got to judge your angles, you've got to use the right club, you've got to, you know, there's a lot of maths that go in there, a lot of thought, insight, and all that. But physically and mentally, what's the game? It's like playing board games. At least if you're running around the track, you're getting something out of it. Win or lose, you've got something out of it. These are all made up sports for mental tickles. What do you get out of Formula One? I don't think we'll need sermons after this. You can use this on a Sunday. What do you get out of Formula One? There are scientists who experiment on these things, you know, physics advances, yes. Like material science advances, yes. Aerodynamics advance, yes. And you know, a lot of industries benefit out of that. I get that. The car industry benefits from that. And various fields of science develop, they expand, they grow, all that is good, all moving in the knowledge direction. But at the end of the day, besides the paycheck, the glory, the fame, which are all nonsensical anyway, because if you didn't have that ego, then glory and fame are merely, it's merely just dust. It's not a mountain, just dust. So all of this is just feeding egos. What do they gain out of it? And the risk that they take? Those cars are designed to be fast, not safe. They're not like your domestic cars, not your domestic vehicles. You know, they're not designed to be safe, they're designed to be fast. So then you have to compromise on safety. Haven't you seen when they have these accidents on those tracks? But all for mental kichi. This is not a criticism of anyone or the people or the communities. It's not that. I just want to try and help open people's eyes. That is my only intention. I really hope you people understand that. If you think that it's something else, please get up and leave or just switch off that video. Don't watch it to the people watching this online. Honestly, my intention is not to hurt. But someone has to open your eyes to this truth. Like I said, 1 + 1 = 3. When you do it, how many times? Last week I asked you this question. 1 + 1 = 3. When you do it, how many times? Then, many of these sports, they were there when you arrived. When you landed, they were there. When you were born, they were there. So you were indoctrinated to think that it is the norm. It is right. This is what we're supposed to do. So you just went with the flow. But what do you gain out of it? Physical exercise is necessary. Absolutely. I try and give myself physical exercise as much as I can. As a monk, whatever is allowed for me to do, I do that. Because it's essential for fitness, to keep myself healthy. It's essential. Because this body is actually here. Mental health, mental well-being is also essential. That is also essential because I have a mind. And for that, the only answer is the Dhamma, nothing else. So what about all the other things that are neither physically, they are neither support the physical well-being nor the mental well-being? Mental tickling is not mental well-being. I'm not a social piranha. I'm only here to help you open your eyes and see that what the world says you're supposed to do is a complete hoax. People just keep on digging pits around you, and without you knowing, you fall into it. And the moment you come out of one, you fall into another one. And the moment you come out of that, you fall into another one. This is what's happening to you. You know, I'm not suggesting you must all come and live monastic lives like I do, but at least if you remain in your lay lives, do things that are sensible. Don't just do things because they're sensational. But you are highly influenced by a sensational society, a sensational media, sensational TV programs, the sensationalism culture. Very easy to fall into that. No one criticizes you for that. Do what is sensible, ladies and gentlemen. Think about what's right, not just because someone says so. Not because your parents say so, not because your teachers say so, not because I say so. Not because the Buddha says so. Because after all, it's not the Buddha's life you're living your life, isn't it? So just because the Buddha says, doesn't mean you've got to do it. You've got to do it if it's the right thing for you. If it's in the Tripitaka, must we all do it? Just because it's there? No. Then if it's in the Bible, must we do it? No. Not because it's there. But if it makes sense to us, then we do it. That is why we are all gifted with intelligence. Right, talking about intelligence, let's come back here. Doctors of the past, our ancestral doctors, the village doctor, they were karmologists. So their teachers taught them about karma as much as they taught them about medicine. Those two disciplines went hand in hand, always. That's why doctors of the past would always advise and recommend as part of your treatment plan to do some meritorious deed. Sometimes they might even say, go and do a Bodhi Puja, right, for the next 7 days and then come back and we'll start treatment. If you're a doctor today at a private hospital says that, you wonder, are you nuts? You'll ask the doctor that. In fact, you know, here's what people might ask. Doctor, how much can I pay you? How much more must I pay you so that it compensates for that 7 days Buddha Puja, Bodhi Puja? Can I pay extra so that I don't have to do that Bodhi Puja? Can my mother do it on my behalf? Can my aunt do it on my behalf? Can my sister do it on my behalf? And I'll come back in 7 days after she's done it. Who did the karma? Who committed the bad karma? You did. That's your karma now coming as vipaka. Would it be right for your mother to go and do the Bodhi Puja then? What nonsense is that? So doctor's fee is 2,000. You ask, if I pay you 10,000 more, can you exempt me from that Bodhi Puja? Well, you think you can negotiate with karma vipaka? Your money means nothing outside the conventional world. That's why to people who think that money is everything, I say, you have nothing. You are so poor, all you have is money. I know you are not like that. Maybe you used to be, but I know you have changed now. Money is nothing outside the conventional world, ladies and gentlemen. See, I'm a happy man. I don't have a cent to my name. Money does not bring happiness. I used to have a lot of money, but I didn't have happiness. I didn't come into this world to become a rich man. I came into this world to become a happy man. Happiness was what I always sought. So don't think that money can always substitute some whatever else you have to do. Your good karma cannot be substituted by money. You can't pay up for penance. Some vipakas you must have to pay by enduring that vipaka. You have to go through it. That's why, you know, I think people misunderstand when they say upandasita karabu paunata varak vendo kalani. So loosely translated into English, there's an idea that people have, some people have, particularly in the Buddhist community, that if you go to the Kalani temple and you worship there once, all the sins you have been done from your birth are exonerated. Yeah, right. Then don't come here. Kalani is not that Kalani. Kalani is Kalyana. Kalyana is nobleness, noble association. To worship is to become. When do you worship someone or something? When you understand their quality, right? When you understand their virtue. That's when you get down on your knees and wholeheartedly you worship, when you understand that virtue. To understand is to become. So true worship is to become. So varak vendut kalani. Venda is worship. It's not the physical worship. It's the mental upliftment. elevating yourself spiritually to that level. So Kalani is Kalyani. Kalyan is nobleness. That's why Kalyana Mitta is a what friend? A noble friend. So if you become noble, then this saying has meaning now. Any unmeritorious deeds that you have done in this lifetime that would have brought you birth in the four great hells, what happens to them? Forgiven and forgotten. What happened? Yes, only once. Once you become a Sotapanna, all sins committed that would have otherwise brought you birth in the four great hells is gone for good. See, now that has meaning. That's what I say. Just because someone says something, you mustn't fall into that. Associate with people who can help you navigate your life, not just help you do your monthly budget or your yearly finances. Truly ask yourself, you know, back then, perhaps, you know, now you're different because you associate the Mahasangha quite a lot more than you used to. But did you not spend more time with your accountant than you did with the local temple monk, with the priest, with the rabbi? You spend more time with your accountant. What did he do? Help you pay less taxes and earn more money for yourself. You are spending your life earning money. Earning money, making money, saving money. The price you were paying, you didn't even realize how much you were exchanging, the exchange rate. Most people's exchange rate for money is one lifetime. And in exchange they get $1 million. One lifetime. The funny thing is this though, you can't give $1 million and get a lifetime back. You can give a life and get $1 million, but try giving $1 million and getting a life back. So it's not true both ways. It only works one way. So do try and spend time listening and associating with the right kind of people who can guide you. Just because we are older, just because we are more matured, right, because through age, experience, doesn't mean we are wiser. Maybe a 7-year-old is far wiser than you. You need to learn to accept that with humbleness and humility. Just assume there's a 7-year-old samanera, not even a high ordained monk, right? A samanera, a novice, 7 years of age, and comes into the sasana with an understanding, not because his parents pushed him into the sasana, or there's some apala, and because of that they have to go become a monk. I don't get that, but people do that. But 7 years old is enough for one to understand these truths. At age 7, if you are born with the right faculties, with the right intelligence, with the right intellectual ability, capacity, with the good teacher, 7 years of age is far, you know, more than enough. How old was Unita and Sopaka when they understood and realized the Dhamma? 7. So then you have a samanera who is only 7 years of age, and they're an arahantunahanse. You are 70. Lots more experience, of course. That samanera arahantru doesn't know how to tie his shoelaces, perhaps. They don't know how to cook something. They don't know how to make money. They might not even know that the world is round. They think the world is flat. Does that make you wiser than them? See, wisdom is here. Knowledge is on the other end of the spectrum. Typically what happens in society is you are given credit for moving this way. Society honors you for moving this way. So you have a BSc within brackets what? Honors. Right? For moving in this direction. You're honored for moving in this direction. You can get an honorary PhD for moving in this direction. These are things that society can give you, but this is not something that society can give you. This you have to become from within you. All this knowledge may be right for today. Tomorrow they will come and say, no, scrap that. Here's a new set of knowledge. You know, the government could at any point, with people's consent of course, tear down the constitution and make up a new one. And then say, all those law books, discard them. We're going to make law from scratch. That's possible. The next discovery in science might reveal that all science that we understood until now was just utter nonsense. The next discovery might reveal that. But anicca dukkha anatta, all is one, that is timeless. This is why you need to spend as much of your time as possible and available on this side and navigating towards this side of the spectrum. Because the world and its dog will keep pulling you in the other direction. You will be respected for moving in this direction. You will be revered for moving in this direction. People will give you a bigger paycheck every time you do something that moves you in this direction. If today you only have your undergrad degree, get your master's, they will give you a pay rise. Then do your PhD, they'll give you another pay rise. Do a couple more courses, professional courses, certifications, they'll give you a pay rise. What is society doing again? They're saying, hurrah, yay, well done. They're celebrating knowledge, 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 knowledge. This is a knowledge-driven world. Each time you do that, you're moving away from this. This is the elephant in the room that no one talks about. So I urge you, ladies and gentlemen, to be more sensible about the way you live your lives. Every year, at least two or three times, right now we have so many different sports on TV. And so if you become a fan of more than one sport, then at least for 3-4 weeks, maybe sometimes even 2 or 3 months, you are sat in front of your TV or your mobile phone or your tab or something, and you're just consuming, allowing them to consume your time. Remember, you are not getting paid anything for it. You are not making anything out of it because you are the commodity. You are being sold on the free market. This is daylight robbery. You have a problem if someone comes and rapes your child. Physical abuse is okay. Mental abuse is fine, isn't it? If someone physically abuses your child, you've got a problem with that. You will go to the law. But if someone comes and mentally abuses your child, that's okay. How many hours do they spend sitting down playing computer games? Isn't that mental abuse? Every time they click on a fire, kill, strike, right? Steal. There are games named after sins. Grand something. I'm not going to say it out loud. It's a sin. You realize that, don't you? It's a sin. Theft is a sin. And then there's a game named after that. And parents have no problem with their children playing it. But every time they commit a sin there, it ends up here, in their karmic pool. You might say they're only doing it behind a screen and no actual theft is occurring. Yes, agreed. But the thought of theft still occurs. The thought of murder still occurs. Anger still occurs. That's there. Vexation is there. Competition is there. Greed is there. Jealousy is there. All of that is there. How can you say that's innocent? And all of that accrues here in their karmic pools, waiting for the right moment to pay, to come back in, to come into fruition. This is mental abuse, and it's okay. All they have to do is put an age rating, and then it's fine, isn't it? Some games are rated 18 plus. So what, at 18 plus what, you don't do karma anymore? Huh? At 18 plus, you don't do karma anymore, so it's fine. Adult videos? From what age are you allowed to watch them? 18 plus. So from 18 plus you don't have raga. Then I can't wait to be 18 plus. Count me in. If it is so easy to become raga free and therefore karma free. This is all nonsense. I'm sorry to say. Just because there's a video that says, if you are 12 plus, you can watch this. If you are 16 plus, you can watch this. If you are 18 plus, you can watch this. If you are 80 plus, you can watch this. Right? Just because they say that doesn't mean it does no harm to you. Whatever harm an 18 plus rated video does to a 10-year-old, it does the same harm to you. Mark my words. It does the same harm to you. That's why you watch it happily. Because it does that harm to you. That's why you enjoy that video. The fact that you're enjoying is evidence that it's doing harm to you. Prove me wrong if you can. The fact that you enjoy watching that video, especially those parts where it says, this is particularly 18 plus. And you enjoy those parts, that is evidence of what? That is doing the harm to you. Here's what they try to do by putting those age ratings. An 8-year-old has not yet understood that such things happen in society. Well, it's only a matter of time, they will learn it. Now you're simply talking about the conventional harm, the conventional damage. On, shall we say, an unexposed mind, still immature mind, right? They should not be exposed to certain things. I don't deny that. That part is there, yes, I agree. But I'm talking about the harm it does by keeping you in samsara, anchoring you to samsara, generating raga, dvesha, moha up here in the karmic spool. That harm happens to you whether you're 8, 18 or 80. For as long as ignorance is there in your mind, for as long as jati happens in your mind, karma keeps happening, and that karma is not a vitaragi karma, it's a ragic karma. But if you're 18 plus, you're allowed to watch it, aren't you? See? Just because society says 1 plus 1 is 3, that doesn't mean it's the right answer. Doesn't make it correct. I can't change the world. This is too late. What I'm saying is too late. People might even condemn me. They say, what nonsense are you talking about? Come and tell them some Jataka story or something and tell them how to live their lives happily. What is this rubbish you're talking about? Just because they come and invite you to do a sermon, what makes you think you can just go on tearing up the social fabric and talking about these things that 18 plus people are allowed to do and they're supposed to do and they should be allowed to do? How come you can pick holes in every social construct? How dare you say that people waste their time watching cricket and watching football and watching tennis and watching badminton and all these sports? Formula One is what keeps the world going round. I can keep quiet, ladies. I don't have to say any of this. Like I said, you know, my back is not itching for me to say all this. I can stop saying all of this, but at what cost? You know, someone out there, they're just making a big soup. Into this soup, they just keep adding you as ingredients. Picture that. You're simply an ingredient in that soup. The world out there, they're just cooking this big broth. And you're just an ingredient in it. So every once in a while, they just take a handful and add it to the broth. and it's on this fire and you're cooking in it. The ingredients get nothing out of it. They're consuming you. You are not the consumers, you are the consumed. Yes or no? They give you a fancy name and say, you are the consumers. The consumer is always right. Custom is always right. Yeah, well, they make you think what they want you to think and then they say, you're right. Of course, you're right. Right? They first make you think what they want you to think with the advertising, with the special offers, with all the glossy magazines, with the adverts. All that first they make you think, and now once you're indoctrinated, then they say what you say is right because you are the customer, so you must be right. Well, yes, because you're now just echoing the thoughts that first occurred in their own minds. That's why I say you are not consumers, you are the consumed. I'm dead certain you can use this hall from next Sunday for something else. So no sermon next week. No, but seriously, no sermon next week because we have an event at the monastery. 21st next week, is it? Then? The week after? No, there's an event on the 21st. Sorry, I forgot to mention. 21st is next week? Next Sunday? No. Because several of you have been coming asking for a meditation retreat at the monastery. I meant to say it last week, but I hadn't had a chance to speak with you, so I thought I'd say it this week, but this week also I forgot to mention it. My apologies. So apparently next week is World Meditation Day. I don't need a day to meditate. To me, every day is World Meditation Day, because in my world, I'm always meditating. But we just want to make use of this opportunity to invite you to the monastery. We'll have a little program. It's been a while since you all visited the monastery for a program. So next Sunday, we just thought would be opportune for that. And 21st? On the 4th, yes. So the 21st we'll have the meditation day, so there'll be a program next Sunday. And then on the 4th we will have the postponed program from last 30th. Remember the Global Language Initiative that we had planned, and then you know what happened. So we've now replanned it for the 4th of January. I'll give you details about it closer to the day, but for next Sunday we'll meet at the monastery. Because even if we met here, there'll be a party out there waiting for me to arrive with their clubs and whatnot. For having said all this today to you. The world is not ready to hear any of this. Because this attacks, the people feel attacked. Because I'm breaking away their consumers. That is what I'm doing. Bad, it will seem like it. You know, if you seriously take on board some of the things that you hear in these talks, right, you will stop patronizing restaurants. You will stop patronizing beauty salons. Well, that one is hard to break. You will stop patronizing expensive funeral parlors. Because you'll understand that ultimately you're just going to end up on a plate to be served to the worms. So why dress it and have it air conditioned? I'm talking about the coffin. Now why should it be scented? What scent? Scent is not in the coffin. It's in the mind. Now there's no mind to experience it. Isn't it? Fragrance is only a perception. Smell is only a perception. Then you will not go after music and dance and drama and all these things, because you will realize that happiness is already within you. It's by default. You were born with happiness. You don't need to go paying people to make you happy. You don't need to go to the theaters for that. You don't need to go to F1 for that. You don't need to go clubbing for that. You don't need to go dancing for that. You don't need to go to see the dramas. Happiness is already within you. This is about self-empowerment, ladies and gentlemen. To help you find home where you are. The problem is people don't feel at home. Therefore, they always go looking for their home, wherever their heart takes them. You know, I have to say, the expression, your home is where your heart is true. Where is your heart? Someone stole it. Where is your heart? It's with you, right? Well, that's where your home is then. That is where your happiness is. You just need to realize that. Home is where your heart is. You were born with happiness. The problem is you don't give yourself enough credit. You think so lowly of you. You think yourself so low. Because you think yourself so low, now you look up to other people, expecting them to float your boat and to fly your kite and to keep you happy. Then you think you become consumers. But happiness is not out there to give you. Therefore, what should people do? They should now convince you that what they have is happiness, because they don't have it. It's just a lie. So they fabricate that lie, that what they have is happiness, and they feed you that bull kakka. So what happens? You take all that nonsense on board, and then donkey after the carrot. Isn't this life in society summed up in a few sentences? I don't see compassion out there. I don't see compassion out there. But alas, I can't fault them either, because they're also lost. They're blind. You're blind. So blind leading the blind. I was also once them. So I also led. While I was blind, I led more blind people to the land of the blind. Fool's paradise. But then with the compassion that my teachers had towards me, they helped me open my eyes. And then I realized I was fabricating lies and just completely filling people's heads and minds with utter nonsense and leading them down various rabbit holes that there was no escape from. How many points have you gone past where there was no return? See, many of you have gone past many aspects of life, many paths in life, past the point of no return, and now there's no coming back. Though there are plenty of examples. Now there's no coming back. Chances are you're sat next to one. You certainly live with one. Point of no return. Those were not your choices. Those were choices that were fabricated in a laboratory. And then they were planted in your mind. You were not consumers, you were the consumed. A question my mother often asks me, when I tell her the status quo, this is how things are. She asks me, so I'm in answer. But if everyone listens to what you say, and if everyone does what you say, then how would the world survive? Good question. It's a perfectly valid question. And the world cannot go on these things. So if everyone did that, Swami, you know, so then the whole world would collapse. Every system would fail. She says, I understand this is just a case of I scratch your back, you scratch mine. This is all that's going on. But if everyone understood that, then the whole world would just come to a crashing halt. A grinding halt. So what are we supposed to do? I says, yes, Amma, what you're saying is right. But you come back and talk to me when the sun rises in the west. And then I will answer that question. Because a tiny proportion of the ocean that is the human population will hear this, these words. And a yet tiny proportion of the ocean of people who hear this will actually take this on seriously, on board. And then an even tinier proportion of people, of that ocean of people who take it on board, we'll actually do something with it. Because most will take it on board, but then the moment they step outside the Dhamma hall, they will once again be engulfed by the social norms, the way the society works, and what society wants you to think. Because I'm just one voice. I'm just another voice. How many channels do you have at home on your TV? Far more than you can count on your two hands. That many channels you have on TV, this is only one channel. This is only one channel. How many channels are there on YouTube? Countless. As we speak, new channels are being published and launched. This is only one channel. My voice is just another voice. The Buddha's voice is just another voice. And thanks to social media, thanks to the internet, thanks to this interconnected world in which we live, every voice is on an equal platform. Right? It's on an equal platform. And I cannot perform miracles. I cannot levitate or radiate light from my body, because then that would win some followers. That was an insult, by the way. Okay? Don't you ever be like that. Don't you ever be like that. I mean, you can if you want to, but I'm just saying, that is the greatest insult. If you one day decide, this Swami Nuhasa just comes and, you know, picks holes in everything we do. He only criticizes and mocks and does all this. But there's another place there, the person, he levitates and he preaches. And then he radiates light from his body. That is the place we must all go to. Go now. Don't go then, go now. Leave this room and stay outside until they open. Don't be impressed by those things, ladies and gentlemen. Don't be impressed by the fanfare. Don't be impressed by the fireworks, the light displays, the levitations. Those are all worldly. That's why I say don't be impressed by that. Don't be impressed by the drums, by the music, by the dance, by the theater, the theatrical performances. Don't be impressed by any of that. The Buddha said this, and he said this seriously, and he meant every word he said. If when you listen to a teaching, those words have this unique effect on you, where your raga, dvesha and moha subside, and you experience freedom from your own self, then those are the words that was once uttered by a Buddha. This is how he said back then, how to gauge whether a teaching is worth listening to. Never did he say, light works, levitations, magic, miracles. That must not be the yardstick that you use. I am today with my teacher because of the effect that his words have had on me. So this day he has not performed a single miracle, because the miracle is happening within me. That is the miracle. To me, that miracle is enough. So if the other day you come and, you know, some fine day a teacher comes and says, see, I can magically create things. I can manifest things. Look, I can fly. I say, oh yeah, birds can also fly. I can walk on water. Yeah, so can those little insects that walk on water. Those miracles don't impress me. I can walk through walls, and so can ghosts. Help me free myself from raga, which is what hurts me every day, which is what keeps me awake and, you know, keeps me falling asleep at night. Help me come out of the feeling of jealousy, which kills me from within. And the sense of guilt that I have for my previous actions, that always keeps accusing me in my head, time and time and time again, no matter how much I try to reconcile them, they keep on coming back and tormenting me. Give me something that will help me with that. And then miraculously they perform a levitation act. And they say, show some lights. I say, are you not impressed? No, I'm still suffering. Because after everything is said and done, if you are still suffering, ladies and gentlemen, what have you gained out of it? That's like watching sport. It's a theater, a theatrical performance. That's why I say, what is the point in watching sport? That's why I ask you that question. Are you wiser at the end of it? You know the scores, you know their performance levels, you know who came first, and you have more knowledge. That's it. The only thing you got out of that was a mental tickle. Where's the wisdom? Where's the medicine that heals the wounds of desire, aversion and delusion? Where is that? So you must understand, ladies and gentlemen, it's not that people are vile, wicked and vicious, right? They keep throwing these ideas and indoctrinating you because they are blind. I did that when I was blind. So I have no right to accuse them or point my finger at them. Takes one to know one. I was there, bought the t-shirt, I went to the gig. So I know what it was like and I know why I did it. I know I did it for my ego. And I know because I wanted a crowd. I know because I liked the glory, the fame, the respect that I got out of it. And today I'm sick of it. Sick of the actions that I did back then. Embarrassed, in fact. Thanks to the Dhamma, I can free myself from guilt. Thanks to the Dhamma, I realize it was not I who did it. That is what happened. There was no doer, just the Dhamma. The Dhamma has helped me come out of that. Otherwise, I would have been kicking myself every day for all the things that I have said, all the ways in which I have encouraged people to go down certain things and do certain things. Just the expression of love to the woman I wanted to get married to. That alone was a lie. We talked about this last week. I had a rash that I needed scratching. She said she had one. So what did we do? We got to then scratch each other's rashes mutually. It was a mutual scratching. That's what we call marriage. But the things I said, the things I said to impress her, the things I did to win her heart, and all those indoctrinations. Fortunately, we both came across the teaching of the Buddha. And so we both started to heal ourselves. And then she went down the noble path and so did I. Fortunately. But today I know that all of those were lies. That is musavat. When you say you are pretty, isn't that a lie? You are beautiful, isn't that a lie? Because beauty is not in the object. Prettiness is not in the object. It's only a perception. Perceived when the mind is released from vexation. Wasn't intentionally lying, but that doesn't make what was said any less a lie. The intention wasn't there, yes, because I had no understanding of the Dhamma. I had no intention to deceive. But the utterance was no less deceptive. But that was the norm. That is what young people had to do. Express their affection and love and all that and get together and start a family and do what every other idiot had done until then in my family. No, we are born fools, honestly. That's what an idiot is, isn't it? Someone who's a born fool. Of course we are born fools. All humans are idiots. No sermon next week and the week after and the week after. Anyone that is born is an idiot. Simple as that. Because the wise aren't born. They unite with the universe. Once you're united with the universe, there's no need to be born. Because you're omnipresent. There's no need to be born. When you don't accept that you're omnipresent, right? When you don't accept that you're omnipresent, now you're looking for your place in this world. Aren't you? When you don't accept that you are omnipresent, now you look for your place in this world. So when you look for a place in this world, now energy has to combine and amalgamate and gross up and create some shape to give you the perception that you have a place in this world. That is why you are born. The day you accept that you are omnipresent, you don't need to be born again. But what do people do after they're born? Now they go up taking up land. This land, that land, I want this land, I want to buy that land, I want that, buy that land. And they try to now buy the land. They try to buy land. They try to buy whole islands. They try to buy, if they could, the whole planet. If they could, people would buy the whole universe. In an effort to become omnipresent. Don't you see the irony? Am I the idiot here? I don't know. I mean, like, why don't people get this? Once you find a little space on this earth, now you want to buy up more land. So you can go and say, that kandat magetamai, this kandat magetamai. I own all this land, so I'm here, I'm there, I'm everywhere. I have a flat in this country, I have a block of land in that country, I have a cabana in that part of the world, I have a yacht in this part of the world, right? So I'm present everywhere. And one day if you could buy the whole world, you'd say, see, I'm here everywhere. I own the whole world. An effort to become omnipresent. At least a perception of omnipresence. Well, the truth is, you were that to begin with. What a shame. It is so representative of the fact that we all try to be happy, right? What were you to begin with? What were you? Happy. But because of a gross refusal of that truth, what do people try to do? To be happy. And in the pursuit of that happiness, they have forgone the happiness that they were born with. It's the same thing over and over and over again. So what do you do with this now? Okay, now you've heard all this. Now, what do we do with all this? That's the next problem. It all seems so true, makes sense, or at least kind of makes sense. Now what do we do with it? I'm married, I have a family, I have a business going, right? I have a pet dog, I have a fish tank at home, and I have guppyas and goldfishes. What do I do now? My whole life is an intricate web of complexity. So what do I do now? This is the problem. This is why, like I said earlier, some of you have gone past many points of no return. Many points of no return. It's not doom and gloom. You can still do what you can where you are for your salvation up here. If you ask me, is it possible to attain Nibbana without a teacher? In my experience, in my knowledge, I would say no. Because you need constant guidance. It is because your ego always gets the better of you. And unfortunately, it is like, you know, what you're having to do is to try to cut the branch on which you're standing. Imagine you are on a tree. You're on a branch, and then you have to turn yourself towards the bark of the tree and then cut the branch on which you are stood. What does your instinct say? What does your instinct tell you to do? No, don't do that. Because the moment you do that, what would happen to you? You'd fall. What does your teacher tell you to do? Go away, cut it. Your instinct says, don't. That is why it's difficult to do it without a teacher. There's a fear that we always have. What might happen? What might happen to me if I listen to the Dhamma and the Dhamma takes over, consumes me, and then I feel like I have to let go of all these things. And I lose my attraction, my affection, my afflictions and all these things. Once I lose them, and I lose interest in my business, I lose interest in work, I lose interest in golf, I lose interest in F1, I lose interest in my family, my wife, my other wife. And so did I say that? if you start losing your interest in all these things, then what might happen to me? Then that fear takes over. Then you have this sense of paranoia. It takes over. I know many people who don't listen to the Dhamma for fear that if they listen to these teachings, then they will let go of everything. I come back to the point again. There is nothing to let go of. You just need to understand that there was nothing there to let go of in the first place. But even to understand that, they must first listen to it. But how many people have the wisdom, at least the merits, to be patient and listen to a teaching like that? Most people don't listen. I mean, that's a problem. They know too much for their own good. They're on this end of the spectrum. And fast galloping in this direction. Not running, galloping. Because that is what the world encourages them to do. Keep running, keep running, keep running. Be more educated, be more educated. They become so educated to the point that they question everything. And now even what the teacher says is not valid anymore, because me and the teacher are now on an equal platform. That's what happens. Then there's no sense of humility, no humbleness, no piety, no sense of obeisance. All that is gone, no respect, no regard. People want to become equal with their teachers. There's a way to get there. You can't do that by competing with the teacher. Then you become Guttila and Musila. You know how that story ended. Of course, the teacher wants you to become like them and then some. But there's a journey that the teacher took. It's not by competing with their teacher. That's not the path. It's by giving oneself up. Not by perceiving knowledge, but by being prepared to come second, to fail in the presence of the teacher, to accept failure in the presence of the teacher, and to realize that it's okay to fail. That they don't have to win every battle. It's okay to lose. As long as you have the guidance and the protection and compassion of your teacher there. It's okay to lose. Because your teachers, maybe the teacher designed it in that way, that you are supposed to lose that game. So that you would strengthen, you would become more resilient, you would understand how to deal with that. All that comes with the association of that Sangha, the teacher. So, once again, we end with this. What do we do now? Now that you've heard this sermon. That was all just a load of nonsense, wasn't it? For the last 2 hours, 3 hours you've been listening to? What can you do with it? That's like when you're in prison, I'm describing to you how lovely the world is out there. And the beautiful trees and the waterfalls and the flora and the fauna. I'm describing this beautiful world out there, the mountains and the meadows, and you're stuck in a prison cell. But you have the strength to break out if you really wanted to. Don't forget this. Remember it well forever. You may be in a prison cell, but it's locked from the inside. You may be in a prison cell, but it's locked from the inside. No one put you there. You willingly walked into it. Because you looked at other people beside you. They were also in prison cells. So you thought, oh, that's where you ought to be. So you walked into one. You closed the gate shut. You turned the key. And now you're saying, I'm in a prison cell. And Swami Nasa comes and describes the beautiful world out there. He says, but I'm in a prison cell. These iron bars are keeping me from coming and exploring the beauty that you speak of, Swami Nasa. There's paradise, yes, you say, but how can I come? I'm in a prison cell. I'm in a prison, I'm in a cell. How do I get out? How do you get out? The same way you got in. So really, you know, this question that you have to ask me, Swami, so what do we do now? That question is invalid. You know what you have to do. You just have to accept that. Every man, woman and child that walk through the gates of our monastery and are with us today. I'm not necessarily saying that everyone has to be a monastic, but I'm just saying, this is just an example. Every man, woman and child that walk through our gates and today have found home in that beautiful place, they came on their own will. We gave them the truth. That's all we did. We encouraged them, but I never went and dragged anyone in. Because you can't do it like that. Why? Because the cell is locked from the inside. So even if I wanted to, I couldn't pull you out. Even if I wanted to, I couldn't do it. It has to be voluntary, at your own will. The Buddha forbade us from going after people and trying to cajole them, to convince them, to try and somehow manipulate them into the sasana. He said, don't do that, I forbid you from doing that. And there's a reason for that. It is because it doesn't stick then. The Dhamma doesn't work. That is why. then they will come in. But sooner than they come in, they will go out, leaving only a bad mark, a bad impression of the sasana, not only on them, but also on others that were involved. But that doesn't make the truth any less a truth. That is, the cell in which you are, you blocked it from the inside. It's time you realize that. It's time you accepted that. You allowed people to convince you to walk in there, close the door and turn the key. Now there's another voice, albeit we're all on the same platform. That's what the society today makes of us. I'm a monk, but I'm just on the same platform as a... I mean, you know, on this channel you watch a monk, on the next channel you watch a monkey. Right? We are both on the same platform. One's called Discovery Channel, this one's called Discoverer's Channel. Is it? We are all both on the same platform. Because people want equality. Everyone must be on the same platform. So, you know, we have no contention about that, it's okay. But the truth is, you have blocked it from the inside. So, there's no point coming and asking me, Swami Nasa, what do I do now? Now you have told us about the truth of the world. I can see now I have to do a pratikarma. And this, all this karma is all down to my own doing. I can see that jati is occurring inside of me. I realize that raga and dvesha and moha are battering me day in, day out. And I can understand what you're telling me about this world, and there's all these indoctrinations and the advertisements, and that I am not a consumer, but I am only a consumed commodity. I can understand, Swami Nasa, what do I do now? Is the response you're going to get back from me? I say, sir, look at the keyhole. You see that key? Yes. What are you supposed to do with the key when it's in a keyhole, sir? Try turning it at your leisure. I love you, ladies and gentlemen. I honestly do. But my love cannot save you. You must learn to love yourselves. The problem is, right now, I love you more than you love yourselves. That is the problem. There will come a day when you will learn to love yourself as much as I love you. That day, you will willingly turn that lock, open the door and walk out. Until such time, all I can do is talk to you and convince you somehow that there's a paradise waiting outside. Right, let's leave it there. Thank you all for being such a lovely audience, for tolerating everything I had to say, for your patience and your humility and humbleness. None of you stood up and walked out. To me, you know, that only speaks volumes that you're here with purpose. And that you understand why Swami Nasa speaks to you like this. You've never heard sermons like this before, have you? No, right? No, that's it. Because most of those sermons, by whoever, let's assume from lay people, most of those sermons were uttered to please you. Maybe at the end of that, they expected something from you. Maybe a pirikar. Maybe a check. Maybe a meal. Maybe your car. Maybe your daughter. Something. I would also like your son and daughter. But only as much as I like you. to come and go where I'm going to take them. Someone said the other day, Guruhandro is called the Pipe Piper. I asked why. And they said, because he takes all our children from us. To Guruhandro, you are all his children. Not just your children. You are also children to him. The whole world is children to him. But the thing is, you've gone, most of you have gone past those points of no return, which your children haven't yet gone. Therefore, where you have no chance now, they do. So it is not that we want to take your children from you. We have come to take our children back to the Father. Back to heaven. You want to take our children, and you are as much our children as your children are to us. But you cannot walk out now because you've locked those cells from within and thrown the key away. That's why I say points of no return. Once you throw the key away, now you can't walk out. Whereas your children are also in a cell, but they haven't yet thrown the key away. So they can turn that key. And with your encouragement, they will do it. Far easier with your encouragement than without. And convention says that they need your permission. That is not true. Conventionally, yes. And that rule was only laid down after the King Suddhodana requested that from the Buddha. Young monks or young boys who were taken into the sasana before then, did they not attain Nibbana? Did they not become arahants? Of course they did. Prince Rahula is the greatest example. No consent from the parents that he went on to become a great arahant. So therefore, in absolute truths, it is not necessary for parental consent. But the Buddha laid down a convention, because conventions are for convenience. Otherwise the sasana would not have prevailed. Because people would have started hurling accusers and, you know, really going to town about it, and they would not have allowed the sasana to thrive. So the Buddha had to make that decision. He said, okay, from henceforth, we must have parents' consent. That is because parents believe that the children belong to them. That is not true. The sense of belonging is a fabrication of the mind. Just as much as your car doesn't belong to you, your body doesn't belong to you, just as much your son doesn't belong to you, your daughter doesn't belong to you, they are also children of the universe. Just as much as you are a child of the universe. But ignorance always gets the better of you. Therefore we have to come up with these social constructs and live within them. Pity. What a pity. Right, let's take a moment then, ladies and gentlemen. To transfer the merits that we have over quite today, by inviting the Swami now to deliver the sermon, as well as listening to and contemplating the Dhamma, as well as creating a conducive environment for all to come along and practice the path, first and foremost, let us take this moment to transfer the merits that we have acquired to the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas who have since time immemorial protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha and passed it down to the generations of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankfully available to us today to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us take a moment to transfer these merits to the monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries who have always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine, as well as the Mahanayakas, the Annanayaka Theras of all of the chapters who have sacrificed and committed their lives to protect and preserve the Sambuddha Sasana. Let us transfer this message to my teacher, Guru Swami Mahanse, as well as all the monks resident of the monastery and the Anagarikas and Anagarikas attached to the monastery. Let us take a moment to transfer this message to those who make great efforts to disseminate the teachings of the Buddha, be that by transmitting these talks, sharing them out with others, or inviting others to join them. May they all rejoice in this mess. Let us also transfer this mess to our devotees and friends of the monastery, who for the sake of merits to help them attain the bliss of Nibbana, continue to sustain the Mahasangha. This includes all of you who provide the Mahasangha with shelter, arms, robes and medicines, as well as those who pass on their know-how and continue to extend their well wishes. May they all rejoice in this merits, and by the power of these merits, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcoming obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to our mothers and fathers, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews and nieces, our friends, our acquaintances, our employers and our employees, as well as anyone and everyone who have helped us, supported us and assisted us in any way, shape or form. May they all rejoice in these merits. And by the power of these merits, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer this message to the devas and brahmas, spirits and demons, primarily the Sakadeva, as well as all the numerous gods and deities who have committed themselves to fulfill and preserve the Sambuddha Sasana. Let us transfer this message to our guardian deities who keep a watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way. May they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also transfer this message to our forefathers, our ancestors, our loved ones who have passed away in our name, reminding ourselves that in this infinitely long journey of samsara, they will all have been mothers and fathers to us, brothers and sisters to us, sons and daughters to us, and so on. As well as reminding ourselves that today we enjoy the comforts of life in the blood, sweat and tears that they have shed on our behalf. Let us also transfer this message to members of the armed forces, as well as the police force, who sacrificed their lives for the peace and harmony of our nation, as well as to those who have lost their lives in natural disasters and calamities such as the tsunamis and earthquakes, flies, floods, pandemics and so on, reminding ourselves that in this long journey of samsara, they will also have been friends to us, parents to us, brothers, siblings to us and so on, reminding ourselves of this truth. Let us transfer with infinite compassion and an abundance of loving kindness these merits that we have acquired to all of them, and may by the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful plains, they redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plane. May by the power of these merits they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may by the power and blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of arahants on this blessed land. And finally, may you and I and everyone who has made this program a success become a Arahatan Mahanse or an Arahataranin Mahanse in this very life itself and in the era of the Sambuddha Sasana itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. The members of the Mahasangha will now transfer their blessings to you. Raga ginnam nidatva dvesha ginnam nidatva moha ginnam nidatva nibbana parana sukhayam Sukhita Paravetma Nibbana Parama Sukhayam Sukhita Paravetma Mamada Siyalu Loka Siyalu Satvayo Nibbana Parama Sukhayan Sukhita Taravetma Nibbana Parama Sukhayan Sukhita Taravetma Nibbana Parama Sukhayan Sukhita Taravetma Raga gini niveva Dvesha gini niveva Moha gini niveva Nivansapa labeva Nivansapa
ලැබේවා නිවන් සැප ලැබේවා
තුන්දුවන්ගේ සුවිසි අනන්ත මහා ගුණ බලෙන් සියලු ලෝක සියලු සත්ත්වයන් නිබ්බාන පරම සුඛයෙන් සුවිත දරවෙත්වා සාදු සාදු සාදු